This morning, I am going to share with you a letter that was received by the Engaged Zen Foundation some 10 or 12 days ago from a prisoner in Texas. Dear Engaged Zen Foundation, I am currently incarcerated in a Texas prison serving a 25-year sentence. I am writing to ask for free Buddhist books and advice. I was 4 years old when my mother and father divorced. My mother chose her career and my father chose to deal drugs and ride motorcycles rather than raise me. I was sent to live with an alcoholic grandmother and grandfather that was not around a lot, but had to work at his job as a CPA, which was very time-consuming. As far back as I can remember, I was very rebellious and wanted to run away from home, even in kindergarten. As I grew up, it only got worse. I refused to do my schoolwork, homework, and I suffered every type of punishment imaginable by my family or the school authorities, even to the point of having my drunken grandmother whip me in front of my fourth grade class. I was sent to a psychiatrist. It got so bad, but no matter what anyone did, it only got worse. In junior high and high school, educational officials tried to forced me to join sports, football and track, but being rebellious and a loner, I didn't do it. Instead, a rumor was started by school officials that I was a homosexual, and I spent several years getting picked on and chased by people in trucks or people throwing rocks, etc. My grandmother being an alcoholic, I was scared to come home after school, not knowing if she would be drunk, and if she was, what she would make me do. Mostly which she would tell me how everyone screwed her over in life. Sometimes she would ask me to do crazy stuff like dance or yell or both at the same time. I didn't have many friends in school and I didn't have any type of good relationship with my family. Sometimes I wouldn't even talk to them unless spoken to first. My dad and his girlfriend turned me on to drugs and I bought my drugs from him. Alcohol came next, and I really enjoyed the escape it gave me. Girls at school made fun of me because I was so rebellious and stayed to myself, and that I didn't fit in with anyone except the drug users and alcoholics. I started doing crime when I was 14 or 15, and by the time I was 17, was in prison. Being so young, the older inmates tried to steal from me, play games with me, solicit sex acts from me, etc. So I stayed to myself, rebelled against authority, and ended up in solitary confinement most of my time. My family was never very religious, but I was conditioned to believe in God and the Bible like all good, loyal American children are. Not too many years ago, I went to drug rehab and started studying psychology to understand why I did the things I did, felt like I did, and why others did what they did. I gave my life fully to Jesus Christ and decided to be honest from then on and live a virtuous life of truth, love, and understanding of my wrongs, infallibility, and that of my neighbors. Over the last few years, after consistently falling flat on my face over and over again, I've begun to understand that a lot of the things I say I believe, I really don't believe. Using the example of burning myself and not putting my hand in a place where it would be burnt again because I experienced the pain, no, believe faith that I will be burnt again, I come to the conclusion that belief equals action or faith equals action. I started noticing that I said I was a Christian and believed in Jesus Christ, but did not live according to the Bible. I've wrestled with these issues and find many reasons to believe in a life after death, but when it comes right down to it, I truly believe I will just go to a hole in the ground after I die. What I'm trying to say is, I've been conditioned to believe in one set of values, God and the Bible, but logic tells me something different. It is almost like being stuck in the middle of three belief systems, and they're all trying to pull me apart at once. Take people, for example. Number one, the Bible tells me to love others as more important than myself, selflessness. If I don't, I'm going to hell. Trust all people, trust God. Two, the world tells me to give everyone a chance, but watch out for them, because a lot of them are trying to screw you. Trust people sometimes, God also. Three, personal experience tells me people are animals and should be avoided at all cost. Don't trust anyone. I try to do what is right and treat people well, as I would want them to treat me. But usually what happens is people take advantage of me, and trying to avoid a fight, I let it pass and make a mental note not to do anything for that person again, which really isn't fair because people are just spiritually sick, right? They're not responsible for their actions because most of them act out of ignorance and the desire to be happy. So I'm stuck with passive-aggressive avoidance. To be truthful, I don't even know what love is. Most of the time I walk around numb and unattached to people in general, maybe not so much as unattached as indifferent. I just don't care about others or their lives, viewing them more as problems than anything. My alcoholic grandmother recently died, and I felt no great sense of loss like I'm supposed to with the loss of a close relative. We weren't close. And the sad part is that if any one of my family were to die, I would feel no great sense of loss. Nobody's close. I call myself a Buddhist because I can say I agree with the Four Noble Truths and Eightfold Path to Enlightenment. I also meditate for about 30 minutes per day, usually right before I go to sleep. Is there any hope for me to be a normal person? I've spent my entire adult life in prison and will probably be here until retirement age. I don't see any great changes on the horizon. Is this all life is? Just what we have here? Am I gullible to believe in a magical kingdom outside of the realm of sight? And damned if I don't? Are they symbols of life now? If I believe in the physical realm and only want what we have here, and when we die, we go to a hole in the ground, nothing further, am I going to hell? Am I deceiving myself to believe in anything else? Is it wrong not to have faith in the compassionate nature of mankind? I don't foresee myself being in the image of any saint or sage in this lifetime. Can you blame me for my self-evaluation? Is it not selfish to want happiness instead of giving happiness? If you have any books or advice that can help me, I will be eagerly awaiting your reply. The chaplain here doesn't give out any Buddhist books or literature, and we have no Buddhist chaplain or leadership. Thank you for your time and help. Sincerely. P.S. Do you believe in God, heaven, hell, life after death? Why? This, I think, is a very unusual letter in that the vast majority of letters that EZF receives are letters requesting free materials without going into any kind of details or offering any kind of sense of real questioning. This letter stands out in that there's obviously some real searching going on here. So this is one of the letters that I do take time with, and I try to do this with all such correspondence. Much of the letters asking for free books I am forced to put aside because I simply cannot deal with the huge volume. This one, however, struck me particularly, and I did spend the better part of a day responding to this man. And I thought I would share the letter and the response with you here today. Dear friend, and I am not revealing his name or precise location out of respect for his privacy. Dear friend, thank you for your most revealing letter, which arrived about 10 days ago. I'm sorry it has taken so long for me to reply. My work load right now is rather high, and I often cannot get things right away. I'm at a loss to know what to say about the history you present in your letter. To say that I have heard it all before is crass, but what you related in your letter sounds all too familiar. I'm sure that you've heard enough in prison to recognize that what you went through is not uncommon, and abuse and neglect is a theme that others in prison have encountered. Nevertheless, there is also an aspect of your letter which conveys a sense of fundamental intelligence in the questions you ask, in that the questions you ask indicate a high degree of critical thought. I was very moved by what you wrote and the questions you asked. I was so moved that I took the liberty of sharing your letter with a good friend of mine over dinner last night. My friend's name is Pete, and he read your letter as we ate. He was really impressed with what you wrote, and he asked if it would be all right if he wrote to you. I took the liberty of providing him with a copy of your letter, and I trust that this will be all right with you. Pete is a very intelligent man, and he is involved with asking some very profound questions about life. He is not a formal Buddhist, but he has some insight and a thirst for truth that is really refreshing. Back to your letter. To lash out in aggression as a result of mistreatment is understandable. To seriously question, as you do, belief systems and philosophy requires a certain amount of insight, which is rare and commendable. I will do my best to answer the questions you present in some sort of orderly manner. I trust that my observations will be helpful and serve as the basis for further discussion and examination. You talked about constantly falling on my face over and over again. Then you go on to say, I've begun to understand that a lot of the things I say I believe, I really don't believe. This belief business is difficult to understand for most people because it's one of those words which is used so often that we never really examine the implications and meaning of belief. But really, just what does believe mean? I have found that if we persistently bore into this question, asking ourselves in a profound manner, what does belief mean? Eventually, we can come to an understanding of the very nature of belief and fully comprehend what is being said when somebody says, I believe such and such. My own examination of belief has led me to perceive that belief is a mental, psychological process. It involves placing faith in the unknown. It has no basis in reality. Beliefs are irrelevant to seeing clearly and precisely how things really are. From where I am sitting, placing faith in the unknown is an unreasonable activity. If something is unknown, it is just that, unknown. Making up stories to explain what we don't know only serves to hide our discomfort in not knowing. It's sort of like making up stories because we're afraid of the dark. If we become comfortable with the fact that we live in a universe that contains unknowns, then there's no need to adopt beliefs to explain the unknown. What is wrong with saying, I don't know? If we honestly don't know something, I don't know is a perfectly reasonable answer to any question. Being able to admit that we do not know something does not make us weak, unintelligent, or less than. If anything, it leaves us open to learn about what we do not know without any baggage in the form of belief systems that hide reality. There's a world of difference in saying, I believe this or that, and saying, I perceive this or that. We can discuss this in depth, if you wish, as time progresses. The three points you list, love others as more important than self, give everyone a chance, but watch out, people are animals and are to be avoided, are reasonable questions. I would throw even more questions into the mix. One, the Bible tells me to love others as more important than myself, selflessness. If I don't, I'm going to hell. Trust all people, trust God. There are a lot of things in the Bible, some of which are valuable, some of which are highly questionable, and even downright barbaric. Just because something is written in a book does not make it right or wrong. Ultimately, we are responsible for our actions, irrespective of what is in a book. The logic behind love others, if you don't, you're going to hell, escapes me. It's saying you love or you're going to suffer eternal brutal punishment. It doesn't sound very loving at all. As a matter of fact, it sounds like a major threat. It is oppressive, threatening, and an attempt at coercion. Be good or I will be bad to you. Huh? That's not very intelligent at all. Unfortunately, we have not been able to break out of this belief that the coercion taught in the name of religion is a valid way of relating to each other. In reality, people do not respond well to threats. People do not respond well to punishment, being hurt by another or by others. It really does come down to believing that the Bible is unerring and its teachings are valid methods for conducting our interrelationships. The difficulty arises in that we have learned far more about human nature, ethics, and morals since the Bible's origin. 2,000 years ago, it may have had some valid insight into human behavior, and it may have served as a restraint on far worse brutality prevalent in society, but that is no longer the case, it would appear. From a Buddhist perspective, there are a number of questions which arise about your point number one, which we may not consider coming from an Abrahamic tradition, Christian, Jewish, or Muslim. The Bible tells me. Again, like our examination of belief, we may be using words that we really do not understand, nor take the time to question. Bible. That's pretty straightforward. It's a book, some 700 odd pages in length. Tells me. Me. And here is the crux of the matter from a Zen Buddhist perspective. What is this me? This me, this I, that is going to hell no doubt, just what is the real nature of this? Herein is where we begin the path of awakening, by starting to ask questions as to our true nature. Just exactly what are we? What is me? Who am I? At first, it may seem ridiculous to ask such questions. Of course I know who I am. Of course I know what I am. I am a child of God, made in his image and likeness. I have an immortal soul. How do we know these things? Because the Bible tells us so. And we believe in the Bible. It would appear that we have formulated a very nice, neat circle of logic. We delude ourselves into thinking we know who or what we are based on what we believe. However, on close examination, we learn that we really have no idea who or what we really are. If we have to believe we are this or that, we have to place faith in the unknown. That faith is based on the words in a book, which we in turn believe are the words of God, which we believe in because it says so in the book. Do you see the dilemma here? We appear to be dealing with an elaborate belief system that is not based on direct experience of what is. We will talk more about this. Right now, I'd like to hear your feedback on the above. I don't know what love is. This is an incredibly truthful and brave statement. It is very difficult to be able to make this statement. Again, I think it ties back to the question of what am I that we just looked at. It is impossible to know who other is if we do not know who we are first. Likewise, how can we love not knowing either self or other? This is very much an I don't know statement. It is very powerful because it leaves us open for discovery. Your last page, page 4, is nothing but questions. I'll try to answer them all as simply as I can. Maybe later we can discuss them in greater detail. Is there any hope for me to be a normal person? Geez, I hope not. Most so-called normal people are pretty messed up, if indeed anyone can be considered normal. I certainly don't consider myself at all normal. Is this all life is? Yeah, this is it. Just what is here in front of us right now. But that does not at all mean that we're doomed to a never-changing, boring existence. Change is always occurring, and life is never a static condition. That leaves things pretty much open and up to us as to what we make of it. Am I gullible to believe in a magical kingdom outside of the realm of sight? I suspect, just based on the question itself, that you're skeptical, to say the least, of any such kingdom. So I think you pretty much answer your own question. If I believe in the physical realm and only what we have here, and when we die, we go to a hole in the ground, nothing further, am I going to hell? Again, look at what has been said about belief. Consider the question of our true nature, or what are we? Question when we die. Ask who or what is it that dies? And hell? What the hell is hell anyway? The back end of a threat? Am I deceiving myself to believe anything else? Same thing here, the belief issue. A kid believes in Santa, but there's no such person. It's just a fairy tale. No matter how much the child may believe, it does not change reality. If there really was a Santa, the kid would not have to believe. The child would know. That's worth considering. We don't have to believe in what's real. What's real is evident. It is only when we're dealing with the unknown that belief enters the picture. Is it wrong not to have faith in the compassionate nature of mankind? This is a very profound question. I'm not sure I can answer it in a simple and straightforward way. We know from looking at ourselves that we exhibit what we perceive as compassion within ourselves, at least from time to time. We also know that if we're really honest, that we see selfishness arise within us too. So we can speculate that there are aspects of what we perceive as compassion in mankind based on our self-observation. Conversely, there are aspects of selfishness present. Practice, sitting zazen, sitting in dynamic lucid stillness, gives us the opportunity to observe the functioning of the mind in a truly unique manner. It is through practice that we begin to gain insight into some of the questions about our true nature. And the comprehension of true nature enables us to grasp the nature of true compassion. I don't see myself in the image of any saint or sage in this lifetime. Can you blame me for my self-evaluation? No, I don't blame you one bit. But you might be quite surprised to find out later that anything is possible. There's a Joktar tale of the Buddha about a thief and murderer named Angulimala, who became a disciple of the Buddha and a monk. I'm enclosing a copy of one version of this story. Is it selfish to want happiness instead of giving happiness? I perceive that if there's a choice of having personal happiness at the expense of others, then that would be selfish. I don't see wanting happiness in and of itself as being selfish. It seems to be human nature. When we really gain some insight into our nature and consequently the nature of others, then we find that we're happy in being able to give happiness to others, and that is a good thing. Do you believe in God? Nope, for the simple reason that I do not believe, period. Heaven, hell, life after death, why? Likewise, for the reasons discussed earlier, the reasons having to do with the nature of the belief mechanism. Life here and now presents more than enough to keep me busy and involved in working on myself and toward creating a better world. There's never a dull moment, so to speak. And if we're really involved in living fully in the present, the issue of life after death is of no concern. I know that when we come to genuine insight into our true nature, the concern over death evaporates. There is no fear of death, and speculation ceases. I will try to get some books off to you in the next couple of days. I hope I've been able to answer some of your questions and provide some information which will be of value. I wish you the best and trust that you will continue your sitting practice. Please drop me a kite and let me know how you're making out. Be patient. It sometimes takes me some time to respond due to the huge number of letters that I receive. In dynamic peace, Kobutsu. Any commentary?
Questions?
Yeah, that'd be a response to all of us who asked the same question.
Indeed. Life has its moments.
Love the course. Somebody said, poet Rupi, love the questions, and the answers will come.
Any questions? The vast majority of the letters we receive are what I refer to as send me free shit letters. Dear sir, please send me all of your free Buddhist books. Thank you. And I get literally thousands of those. And I think, I know that many of them are prisoners who don't have a specific interest in Buddhism, that are just desperate to get something for free. And given their environment, I don't blame them. I'd probably be doing the same thing myself if I was sitting in prison and someone gave me a prison resource list. It's difficult for me to simply put them aside, but I have to. I can't deal with them. I mean, you know, I have a stack of probably 300 or 400 letters in my office all the time that I just am not able to deal with. Providing books to those people is something I would very much like to do, but without a staff and without funding, I'm not able to do it. Just responding to this man took the better part of a day to write a comprehensive 5-page response. And for people with questions of that nature, and this is just, you know, this is something that his letter struck me as being, you know, something really genuine in that he's definitely, you know, really searching for some answers. And that deserves the best response, the best possible response that we can provide. That deserves that. Likewise, if someone presents letters detailing mistreatment or medical neglect or torture or brutality or you know, serious questions of legal... of a legal nature, those also I will deal with on a direct basis and take the time to fully respond to them. But you know, it takes a long time. I mean that probably took I would say it took me about 4 or 5 hours to write that letter.
Did that letter clarify anything for you?
For me?
Yeah.
It clarified, I think, my ability to communicate. I think every time I write a letter like that, I learn perhaps something a little more about communicating with people. The actual material that's very much a part of my training, but it's the nuance of communicating it to someone in a way that hopefully they'll hear that is what I'm learning all the time from it. So, you know, that's, I think, where I'm coming from in terms of what I'm supposedly getting out of it. I don't know. It's more like practice than gain. But, you know, this is what...
what's being engaged is what it is. Don't just get getting something out there.
It's more than being engaged. I originally started out with the idea that engagement was where it's at. Engaging is... I think over the years, since forming the Engaged Zen Foundation, I've come to realize that it's got to be more than being just engaged. Engaged is almost distant. There's almost a separation in engagement. You know, it's like I'm here engaging with that out there. Well, it's not quite like that. Sometimes it's engaged and sometimes it's enraged. The Enraged Zen Foundation, because some of the stuff that comes in is more than just, you know, engagement. I mean, when you hear of people being, you know, brutalized and tortured and killed through medical neglect, you do become enraged. It becomes enraging. And I think the energy of that rage that sometimes comes up is valuable in responding. And it's more than just engaging. Engaging is almost too clean. You know, it's almost too ephemeral and too sort of, off in the clouds. I think we need to really get in there and at the nitty gritty level and deal with it. You know, we've got to be prepared not to remain aloof, but to be very much a part of what's going on. So it's not just engagement. It's marriage. It's not even that. It's far more, far closer than that. But I'm not about to change the name of the foundation because that would involve a lot of paperwork. But I do think that over the past 12 or 13 years, I've definitely come to be more than or see more than just engagement. You know, engagement is almost too clean.
Well, I'm hearing compassion.
Compassion's a really loaded word because you read about compassion. We talk about compassion, but I don't think that we can fully experience compassion prior to awakening. And that I think is really the crux of true compassion is it's predicated by the awakening experience. We can practice idiot compassion to no end, and I think that the vast majority of what passes for compassion out there is idiot compassion. And that is because we do not fully examine and expose ourselves in the process. being truly compassionate involves a lot of really direct exposure. It's standing naked out in the middle of the street. It's bearing one's own soul. And it's very easy to, Trungpa Rinpoche used to describe it as sort of a, as idiot compassion is having a very much a less than attitude towards others. You know, I am this great Buddhist priest, this great Buddhist teacher who is reaching out to these poor bastards in prison, these poor miserable wretches who are in prison, and offering them the wondrous teaching of the Dharma. You know,
and they better accept it, goddammit.
and I'm making their lives better, and you know, the recidivism rate and all of this stuff, and it's all crap. It's total crap. You know, it's total crap. I mean, you get a letter from a man like this, and you know, this man is doing some genuine, deep questioning. And this is as valid as any, you know, high zazen done in the fanciest Zen monastery in the world. It's just as valid, because the process is given, you know, given the surroundings and given what this individual has to work with, the process that they're going through is just as profound and just as deep in its penetration of self and reality. So we can learn a tremendous amount from people in prison. So it's not just about reaching down to the poor bastards. It's about being with others as self, being with brothers and sisters as community, so that we're as much open to learning from them as they are from us.
It's expanding the identification.
It's very inclusive, yeah, very much inclusive. It's what Thich Nhat Hanh talks about when he talks about interdependence or interbeing. We're not separate. We're not, you know, we're not holders of the Dharma bringing it to the ignorant. You know, that to me is an incredibly arrogant and aggressive approach, and it's plain downright wrong. This is not true Dharma. This is egocentric power over dynamics. So there's a lot to be learned, a lot to be learned. And I think prisoners, and we can learn an incredible amount from prisoners. And we can learn an incredible amount about ourselves in dealing with people in these situations. You know, it starts out, you know, very simply, just looking at words and how we use them, as in the letters, you know, we looked at examining the word belief and what to believe means. If we look at just in the prison situation, we see that we have the government and those who run these places, these prisons, referring to them as correctional facilities, as though these words somehow convey something other than prison. And we hear the people inside that are incarcerated in these places as being called inmates. You know, and we have the image that an inmate is someone somehow in a hospital environment who is being, cared for and healed. Well, that's absolute horseshit. These people are living in prisons, and they're prisoners. If we attempt to change that fact and call them by a different name in order to, sort of hide the reality, then I think we're missing the boat. So I don't even use the word inmate, the I word. Prisoners. And these people are not in correctional facilities or anything like that, or correctional centers. These are prisons. They've got bars and, you can't get out. And the people in these places are prisoners. You know, inmate sounds, watching a lethal injection procedure. Procedure. What is this procedure thing? They have what's called an execution protocol. Top secret document that describes every step of the process, all choreographed, moment to moment to moment, precisely what is going to happen. The inmate is brought into the execution chamber, which is outfitted with medical equipment, with a gurney, with intravenous feeds, with, everything is white and sterile and... Yeah, it's just like an emergency room. I mean, to look at this, you'd think, well, this is an emergency room or something, and so it's medicalized. And
does that include swabbing?
Swabbing, absolutely, right.
The needle site
is swabbed with alcohol because that's procedure to prevent infection. That's in case after they get the needle in, the governor calls and says, cancel the execution. That's so the guy doesn't get infected. Guy or woman, or child. I mean, my God, we've got states that permit execution at age 16. It's an abomination. But to call it execution conveys one thing, in reality it's murder. And it's the coldest of cold-blooded murders imaginable. It's far colder than anything else, because it's done so deliberately and with such such planning. It's the most premeditated of premeditated killing. But in any event, I did want to share that letter with you, and I hope that it is as inspirational for all of you as it was for me when I read it. And I'm really, really grateful to this individual for writing that letter, and I'm grateful for having the opportunity to have been able to respond to him. And it's getting on in time, so I think at this point our talk will be over, and we'll do our formal closing with chants, and thank you all for coming. And we will see you all next week. Daibusatsu Zendo is in session right now. Sean is in the second day of Dai session. Great session, big session. Next Sunday we will meet here, and I think Sunday afternoon, hopefully if I'm able to get the money together, I will be driving up to Daibusatsu to take part in Edo Roshi's 70th birthday party, which should be kind of a...
Hopefully plenty of sake.
Maybe a little sake here and there. Maybe.
Yeah. Maybe
a
little flash, finger on flash.
Maybe some bubbly, you know. Chivas Regal, you know, he's probably won't be much Jack Daniels. Chivas Regal, maybe. Or a fine single malt. But I'm looking forward to seeing Sean, and I'm also looking forward to celebrating Roshi's 70th birthday. It's I've been around him for a long, long time, and we've sort of grown old together. So, thank you all, and have a good week.